Hello, everyone. Thank you for checking in to another episode of The Naturalist Capitalist. On the other end, I've got Andrew from Popular Liberty. How are you doing tonight, Andrew?
I'm good, Reed. Glad to be here.
So before we get going, I just wanted to ask you, do you like Alec Baldwin's Trump impersonation or his Cheney impersonation better? Which do you think he pulls
off? Dude, that was a hilarious tweet that you had. That was LOL funny. And also, before we start, I love truckers. Y'all are the best drivers on the road. Everybody else sucks.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not a religious person, but I do believe in hell when someone tries to pull up on the right side of me when I'm trying to take a right turn.
There's seriously, man. It's like, you know that that's what's coming. And, you know, it's like, and they know it too. And they just like, don't give a shit. But it's like, yeah, they should burn in hell for that. I agree.
Well, I mean, you know, they come slow when you're like trying to make a left turn and they space it just right so you can't like squeeze in between them. But then they go super fast if they see you coming. They're like, oh my God, it's a truck. And then they pull right out in front of you and then they slow down when you're going up a hill.
Like, don't you understand? This is like 18 tons of steel. It's like, do you really want to get in the way of this? Like, I can't slam on the brakes, but it doesn't work like that. This is basic physics. So, yeah. And you know, every time I see a trucker on the road, I'm like, okay, thank God. At least this guy's not going to be a total idiot and just come right over in front of me. You know, it's like that, you know, whenever you're going 80 miles an hour and, you know, you don't have a few car lengths of, you know, a space in front of you. And people just like, oh, that's a free opening. Let me go right in. And then you have to slow down. And then the guy behind you has to slow down. And it's like an accordion effect. And it slows everything down. It's awful. But truckers don't do that to you. They're very, very nice. And if you put your blinker on, they will slow down and let you over. And because that's what good humans do. Bad humans don't do that. And fuck them. You know, they should be, yeah, you know, given the ass end of the state. So
yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, truck driving taught me a lot about low time preference. You know, that was where I learned it, because it's just like, okay, well, these guys are all retarded, so I just got to let them do their thing and not run them over. So it is what it is.
You really have to, though? I don't. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, yeah, it doesn't work out well for the driving record in the future. But
yeah, that's true. That's true. You got insurance to pay.
Yeah. So before we get into archotropism, the anti-tax, all this stuff, I want to know a little bit about your history. Just give us like a 5-minute cap. I know your dad was a boomer con, and then you were kind of like in the Libertarian Party, or at least like a libertarian.
No, I was always a kind of a natural libertarian, just temperamentally. And the like that was a my father was like constitutional conservative. He's more like a Rush Limbaugh type rather than a neocon. And I always had a really good exposure right away. Like, I got my first red pills from Rush Limbaugh. That, you know, okay, the media is evil, and it's not that they're biased, they have an agenda. And you know, and so that gave, and I had that really early in life, so I credit that as, you know, the first few red pills I took, which naturally led me down the path of you know, libertarianism. Then and just that natural engineer brain was, you know, kind of what really led me there first, you know. I'm too young to have been in the Ron Paul, you know, age, but I was still like in high school or middle school at the time, depending on which campaign you're talking about. But, you know, just I had a natural libertarian temperament where I'm like, okay, I can clearly see that, like, you know, on the social issues, even though I was raised very heavily Catholic, very Christian, that, okay, well, this prohibition stuff on, like, you know, sex and drugs and, like, okay, this shit doesn't work. And, you know, you can't call these things moral if they don't work, you know, and seemed like the libertarians were the ones who really understood that well, is that, okay, things actually have to work in order to be ethical or moral and stuff like that. And that's what really attracted me to the ideology at first. So
okay, so how did you kind of transform to where you are now? How long of a time period was that?
Well, about 4 years ago was when I first invented the anti-tax, and that was kind of my first major transformation, you know, because I had figured out how to run a government without taxation. But then I started looking for, you know, kind of control mechanisms for it, because I realized, okay, you can't just like let this thing go, you know, you actually have to manage it. And it was that process where I got archotropism from. I got the first two laws pretty quickly. And, you know, kind of just by myself, I had the natural understanding of just Misesian praxeology, and I didn't even know what either of those two words were. And eventually I was, you know, I always enjoy comedy and good humor, and I've been searching for Andrew Heaton videos, and I stumbled across Dave Smith. And I saw his an interview he did with Reason, and I'm like, oh, this guy seems pretty based. I like this guy. You know, it's apparently he's a comedian too. Okay, I love Haha Funny with politics. Let's see what his Libertas special, because that was what it was about. The interview was interviewing him about his Libertas special. And I'm like, oh my God, it's like busting. I got laughing. I'm like, oh, I got to follow this guy. And that was when I, you know, started really listening to Dave Smith. And as of today, I'm the admin in the part of the Problem Inner Circle, which is actually alive and well. It got nuked on Facebook, but you know, I was, you know, there and ready because I got nuked the day before by Zuck. And I realized that this was a wave purge because a whole bunch of people, like pretty sure Michael Heist got, you know, nuked the same day I did. And so I realized, oh, so this is a wave. And I'm thinking, gosh, how did I get caught up in the first wave? I'm nowhere near the worst person in the part of the Problem Inner Circle. And then I realized, oh, I'm not the worst person. And they're going next. So, okay, they're about to ban everybody. Let me go set up a sister platform, you know, something on another platform that's not going to ban us. And then sure enough, the next day, everyone else got banned. And, you know, I just, you know, Gaze sent everybody a message from the membership list of, hey, here's a new place. Let's go have the same exact thing here. And so basically, but that, yeah, that was my transformation, was I started really listening to Dave Smith. And, you know, I could see that, okay, well, I have this archotropism thing. I can see that there's some problems with what he's saying, at least functionally. Ethically, morally, he's like dead on, you know, he's like, but there's nothing wrong with that, you know, with ANCAPs when they come to, you know, kind of morality usually. But, you know, functionality is a different question. And, you know, I feel like those two actually need to be answered together, not just separately. And
sure. So give us like the kind of rifle through archotropism. It's got six laws, just kind of like lay it out, and I'll just jump in and ask a question if I'm confused about something. So
yeah, I think we probably have time for at least the first three, which are kind of the main three. I separate them. The first three are what I call protogenic, you know, they're the source of the problem. Whereas the second three are like mutagenic. This is where they cause like mutations, and they cause, you know, why is it all states don't look exactly the same? You know, why is it, you know, they look different? Why do they behave different? These are basically mutations in the value incentives. Archotropism is basically all about, it's a praxeology of the state. This is why, you know, the economics of statecraft, I call it sociopathic economics. And with archotropism, I usually define these things into three laws, or at least for these first three. Yeah, we're talking about the value of aggression, really, the value of coercion, that aggression has value. Obviously, that's kind of, you know, just self-evident that, you know, it has value to the aggressor and has a negative value to the aggressee, you know, the victim. And so the victim obviously has a incentive to resist because they don't want the negative value. And whereas the aggressor has the, you know, incentive to aggress because that's value to them. There's you know, all kinds of different value with that. you know, it's like you could just wanting to control someone's behavior for whatever reasons you think aren't good, and everyone thinks their reasons are good, so whatever. And or you could just want to take something, you know, from them, take a piece of property that has obvious value. But what this adds up to, because you have a negative value on one side and a positive value on the other, what that means, and you know, you have one person who wants to be the aggressor, the other person wants to either resist and fend off the aggressor. Well, that means that the value of that act has to be a risk versus reward trade-off. Therefore, the value of power is always relative. The value of an act of aggression is always relative, and that's relative from the aggressor's point, from the aggressor's ability to successfully aggress against the victim. And the first problem that causes, because it has a relative value, means it can't be created or destroyed. And anytime you create new power, all you're doing is transferring value. So it's not that the power itself cannot be created or destroyed, it's that the value of power cannot be created or destroyed. That means this thing's basically immutable and there's no getting rid of it. And that's a there's no way of getting around it, because even if you like if you have like gun control or something like that, and you try to get rid of all the guns and all the weapons, you know, and what's actually left over is, you know, the people who still have them have basically all the power in the room. Because like if let's imagine you and I are in a room with 100 people, and each of the 100 people has a gun and a bag of money. And, you know, what's the value of aggression? It's basically equally split between 100 people, because we're all heavily armed, and we don't really have the ability to aggress against each other successfully, or at least, you know, our chances are really, really bad. Therefore, we're probably not going to do it. And, you know, given the gunshot has a very asymmetric, value in that sense. So that the risk are substantially higher. Whereas if I wave a magic wand and 99 of those guns disappear, y'all are all sitting ducks now. And basically I'm God. And it's, and in that sense, you actually had the value, the actual power in the room actually went down because you got rid of 99 guns, but the value was conserved into the one gun. And now I'm basically God in the room, and I can just make you guys do whatever the hell I want and give me all your money. And so, like, because you can increasing it, the amount, you know, does the same thing. So, you know, I can add more power into a system, and, you know, by just creating extra firepower or something like that. But again, all that's doing is, you know, basically, I guess, I don't know how you would do that, but, maybe I have like a magic gun that can shoot, like 10 bullets, you know, in 10 different directions at once and hit every target. I don't know. Maybe I have a magic gun like that. And, you know, so now, I actually have an advantage in the same room of all these people who have, you know, guns with me, because I actually have substantially more magical firepower or something like that. And right. Yeah, so that, so that's the first thing to understand is, power cannot be, its value cannot be erased. And this is something you get into with, when you study Mises, is that he's, you know, very clear that, you know, when he talks about the government, that as long as this thing has value, as long as an act has value, it's going to get done. And whenever you do you try to prohibit some sort of act, all you're doing is creating pent up demand that's going to get supplied. So like if you make pent up demand for drugs, you know, people are still, you know, you can make a prohibition on it, but people still want their drugs. And you can make a prohibition on alcohol or sex work, and people are still going to want that. So it's still going to get supplied. It's just going to get, you know, you're going to have a risk premium that you pay. It raises the price. It makes more people want to supply it, you know, because they take that risk. And same thing happens with aggression, is that if you try to just prohibit aggression, like what you're going to end up with is basically a black market for aggression, which will naturally consolidate itself into a bunch of supplier, you know, into a cartel of suppliers, which is basically what we have today.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, do you agree with Tolkien that power is like the number one thing humans desire? So it's kind of ridiculous to think that they're not going to always want it. I mean,
exactly. And this is something you understand with the action axiom from Mises, is that, you know, humans, they use means over a period of time to achieve ends. And well, what if one of those ends is power? It's like, okay, well, they're going to do that. And, you know, and of course, they're always going to do it to the extent that it has maximum value, because humans are economizing monkeys. And, you know, this is, you know, if any sort of act has a value, people will try to maximize that value. And unfortunately, aggression has value. There's no way to get rid of that value. And it will always have it. Like, we've been aggressing at each other since we were like banging rocks together. And, you know, it's like there's no way to get rid of it. So it's going, so, you know, however we maximize that is, you know, is to the size and scope of the state, you know, however profitable that is going to be the size and scope of the government. And that's the sort of thing we actually have to deal with, is, you know, how profitable it is to be a state is the central problem, not the fact that it exists in the first place. And right. And that's like one of the first things I noticed about kind of ANCAP theory when I was coming through, you know, the more ANCAP mindset, is that, oh, this, you know, this thing they're talking about with Misesian praxeology, it's kind of assuming that, you know, the value of power is not a thing, or the value of aggression right. just doesn't exist.
I know you've pointed it out before, but it's kind of like communists, how they deny that supply and demand exists. ANCAPs are sort of doing the same thing with power, because there's a supply yeah. and a demand for power. So it's just the same thing on both sides of the spectrum.
It really is. Yeah, both are engineering issues, because you have to understand that both are kind of constants, that it's always valuable to be productive. It's also always valuable to be predatory. Therefore, both are going to get done. And unfortunately, both conflict. And so the, you know, how you resolve that conflict is going to have to be some sort of social engineering. And, you know, just by, and you can just see that almost a priori, you know, that, you know, like Rothbard has talked about, hey, you know, when you predate against someone, you are disincentivizing them to be productive, because you're, and that's what actually lowers the amount of production, is that, that further disincentive. But the, you know, so, and, you know, we obviously don't want that. We want that predation side to be minimized as much as possible. And this isn't quite a minarchy argument, but it's a description of the problem. Like, I'm not mm-hmm. arguing for minarchy, you know, as like, you know, I'm just saying that this is probably inevitable, and we need to figure out a clever way of dealing with this. And because, again, you can't just prohibit your way there. You know, all that's just basically gun control. It doesn't work. And just prohibiting something only creates a pent up demand for it, which will usually explode in your face. When it comes to a state, that might be literal.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it seems like the state has a tendency to consolidate, but at the same time, it tends to break apart, because once it gets too centralized and too big, it can't do anything, like the Soviet Union, and it falls apart. So how does archotropism address that? I know it does.
Yeah. Well, okay. The consolidation is actually, you know, kind of interesting, is I'm having a conversation with an actual economist right now to try to, you know, fix some of the parts of archotropism where he feels I'm not being, you know, quite specific enough. And this is one of the things he brought up initially as a counter argument, and I disproved it pretty quickly, that because when you have that relative value, what that actually incentivizes is, instead of for power to fight with each other, because remember, when you're fighting, that value is substantially less. But when you're cooperating with each other, that value is substantially more, because so second law of archotropism is that, you know, power seeks consolidation from low concentration to high concentration, and predation is just defined as the consolidation of power. I got that definition basically straight from the left, yeah, because they're the ones who really understand power, and they just have like an unfathomable love for it. But because of that, you know, whenever you have a high concentration of power, basically what that's saying is, you know, when it seeks consolidation from low to high, that means that the strong prey upon the weak, no duh. And yeah, the reason for it, but the reason for that is that that's the only, you know, kind of act that has value. Like, if you're a weak person, you really don't want to go up against a strong person. You're going to get your ass kicked. And so, but if you're a strong person, you can just go take the kid's lunch money and it's, you know, whatever. And mm-hmm. you know, so that actually does have positive value. That's why it gets done. But, you know, as for why it consolidates itself, well, imagine you're like a robber on the block you live on or whatever. And, you know, there are a whole bunch of, everyone else is a mark, you know, when no one else is a predator. And then, you know, another gang, you know, moves in, you know, right next door to you. And now they could be competing with you for the same marks, you know, and that would theoretically mean less for you and less for them. If you compete with each other and you're like shooting at each other and you're dying, and that's not great. But what would actually make a substantial amount more sense is that if you actually just join them and you consolidate your forces, and that way you are a much bigger consolidation of power against the regular people who have basically no power. And, you know, so, and by doing that, by being the bigger center of power, you're in basically increasing your chances of, you know, of successful predation. And if you really wanted to, you know, get technical about it, you got big enough where you could afford economies of scale. What you could do is, you know, maybe hire a journalist or a prostitute, as I call them, you know, where you could, yeah, you could, you know, just hire them to go write flattering articles about how, you know, your predation is actually raising the aggregate demand or something like that, and that helps the economy somehow. And you know, you're not really robbers, you're keeping the peace or something like that. And you know that. And or you could hire like an accountant who can you know, make tell you you know, oh, this he can keep track of who's paid you their protection money for the month or what or whatever, because numbers probably are not your thing if you're a predator. And mm-hmm. you know, so it's like you can you know, start having all these extra specialization type jobs that, you know, help increase your productivity. and that's something that, and you could easily you could pool your resources with the other predators to afford such specialization of skills that are non-predatory by nature, but, you know, in fact they are. And so that, you know, just that relativity of value naturally incentivizes power to want to work together, want to consolidate itself. And the only reason you end up getting, you know, wars is that, you know, it's like, well, okay, at that consolidation, you're talking about a merger and acquisition, who gets to be at the top? Because there's really only can be one. And, you know, whenever they can't agree about who should be at the top, that's when you get fights, because that's the only real scarcity there. And, but you will get fights, you know, because of that. But power always does seek to, you know, once someone wins, basically the army joins up. And, you know, at that point, power is consolidated.
So do you think once it reaches a certain point of consolidation, it does break apart? Like, it can't stay together? Or,
well, what ends up happening is, you know, this is kind of due to the fourth law of archotropism, is that, you know, the fourth law is that, you know, the power itself is equal to force divided by distance and time. The reason I put it that way is that, you know, what it's telling you is that distance and time are a cost to power. They're a cost to force. And by the way, the force itself is also not free. And so what happens is, as you spread out, you know, you have to, you know, spread out, you know, your force, you eventually get spread too thin, and it gets too expensive because it's too much distance, too much time. Both of these are logistical costs, you know, to power. And eventually it becomes unprofitable to, you know, to exert power. So you saw this like in Rome, where Rome would just constantly overextend itself militarily. Same thing with the global empire America has right now, is that it's fucking expensive and to be a global empire. And just because you have to, you know, actually bring the force physically, and, you know, to over distance and time to apply that force. Like, I can't, you know, you and I are separated by many, many miles right now. I can't have like a finger gun right now and say, give me your money, Reed. This, you know, so, you know, I'm not physically present to actually apply that force to you. In order to actually have power, you have to be physically present at the time to apply the force. And, you know, that costs money, because, like, okay, you have to move the army from point A to point B. That's not free, you know, and you have to move the Navy all the way around the world and be in all places at once, basically. That's really fucking expensive. And what ends up happening is that, you know, the predation, you know, the empire will like fall apart because it's just not profitable.
And yes, you can have those two happen at the same time, right? You can have some parts falling apart because the government can't handle it anymore, while other stuff is consolidating because people are worried about something. Like, yep. I mean, we kind of have that going right now. Like, the supply chain is falling apart, but at the same time, a lot of people are pushing for more and more control over COVID regulations and shit. So they're not necessarily one after another. They can happen simultaneously, right?
Yeah. And of course, any nature abhors a vacuum, including a power vacuum, and someone will always step up to fill that. And, you know, preferably someone a little bit more peaceful, but, you know, beggars can't be choosers. So,
right. Yeah. And, so you kind of feel like we're in that scenario right now, right? Where things are falling apart and
they're in transition.
You don't predict the future. You just look at patterns. You look at, exactly, like, the way things go. But you feel like, you know, we're kind of in a place where we're setting up for wanting some sort of absolute power because everything's falling apart, just like it did in Rome. Do you want to explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, with archotropism, you know, the actual definition is that, this is the method by which the state grows its power by extracting order from chaos. The reason being is, again, we mentioned that, okay, this state is here to, you know, basically give people, supply them with an aggressive order. And, you know, and because even if you're a libertarian who believes in a defensive order, well, okay, well, what's the best, you know, remember that humans are economizing monkeys, we maximize value. So, well, what's the best, well, what's the best kind of defense? A good offense. Yeah. And it's a problem. And so even by just saying I want a defensive order, you're at, you know, at, because humans are economizing monkeys, we're going to naturally end up with a aggressive order. So the state is here to supply us, you know, with aggressive order. And so whenever like you have a chaos, you know, which I say, you know, I would define that kind of as a perturbation of the natural order, you know, that's, you know, referring to a little bit to natural law. And but anytime you have a perturbation of the natural order, the way things are supposed to work, you know, due to our natural incentives of what is actually maximizing value. So anything is substantially less than that is a perturbation. And so, you know, whenever you have, you know, a major outbreak of chaos, you know, like a panic of some sort, this is when the state will try to power grab, because they'll see that instinctively as a shortage of order. And they'll say, hey, if you will, you know, pay us in power, you know, which, by the way, we're never, ever going to give back, you know, then we will, you know, resupply you with more order. We will put down the chaos and put down the panic, and just, you know, you just have to pay us in power, and then we'll make all of your fears go away. Of course, that's a lie. You know, they really are here for predation, but they've hijacked this aggressive order demand that people have. And the you know, so whenever you have like with Rome, you know, when this thing was like falling apart, you know, because, you know, at this point they're a republic, they've way over consumed wealth, and there's nobody, their neighbors are like, you can't loot them anymore because they've already been looted so many times for hundreds of years, and it's like, okay, there's nothing left to loot. And at that point, this thing just basically is falling apart. And you and all over the place for like the last few hundred years of the real, you know, Rome proper empire before the barbarians sacked it, you know, you would have one emperor after another that would just die. And he was really not an emperor. He was at those point, they were just dictators because they couldn't hand it down to their kids ever. And that just, that didn't work. They basically just did a long string of dictators. And what would happen is that every time an emperor died, you know, it would be like all of the generals would be like, I'm the emperor now. It's like, I just nominated myself. And, you know, and then they would have a war with each other to figure out who, you know, who was actually going to be the emperor. And, you know, that was, and then so that squandered all of Rome's wealth over and over and over again. And the, but the reason, you know, you have something like that is these are the only people who have the power. That's it. And, you know, right now, that's the incentive when, you know, when you have an outbreak of chaos, like a dead emperor, it's like, I want to be the one to re-extract the order. And by order, I mean, I'm in charge. And, that's kind of that's, and you see the same thing with like the state nowadays, where they actually will like straight up say that you never let a good crisis go to waste. So the you know, you have like this outbreak of COVID in 2020, you know, and the state was like, oh my god, a terrible pandemic, quick, bail out the bankers. You know, it's like, well, nobody's looking. It's like, of course they're gonna do it, like straight power grab, you know, just like that. And they didn't have to think twice. It's like, quickly bail out that, you know, their first priority is let's bail out the bankers. And yeah, it's like, and yeah, the federal reserve's like, no, wait, I'll beat you to it. So it's like that. This is the natural behavior, is that they, you know, and then they're like, oh, well, all, we just have to restore order, and we're going to do, you know, just 15 days to flatten the curve. That's all it's going to take. We're just going to force everyone to stay home, and this is all going to be over. And we're at like what, day 200 or something now? Yeah, well over 365. Yeah, or, no, we're over 365 now. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh yeah. So yeah, we're way past that. 18 months in, something like that. And 560 of 15 days to flatten the curve. Yeah, they never gave that power back. And I'm sorry. Your question about Rome, we're in this kind of state of transition right now. The reason for that is that 80 years ago, at the end of World War II, Europe was basically rat fucked, and to say the very least. And, you know, they had just gotten done shooting at each other a lot. And, you know, Stalin's army, you know, the Red Army was on the other side of us, of the U.S. Army. And we were looking at them like, holy shit, these guys are terrifying. They literally just got done raping and pillaging their way across Germany. And we really, really, really don't want to have a fight with them. So we did what Americans usually do with our foreign policy. And we bribed ourselves up an alliance. And we said that, all right, you're all okay. So we understand you, that all of the European allies just got done shooting at each other, and you probably still have some hurt feelings about that. But we're going to need you to all be on the same team now, not behind us, not beside us, but actually in front of us as our human shields between us and the Soviets. And they're like, no, we don't really want to do that. We hate each other. And we're like, how about money? And we decided to bribe them, and we gave them the Marshall Plan, which, basically a crap ton of free money to all be on the same team. They said that that's where you're going to need to sweeten that deal just a little bit. So we decided to bribe up a military alliance of free trade. Basically, this was how free trade was born, where we decided to militarily subsidize everybody else's trade all across the planet. And that's why we have a global military. And, you know, because this was explicitly the deal we made back in Bretton Woods. Instead of having competing empires and competing alliances and supply lines that crisscross each other and all kinds of piracy, this is why we got the golden age of piracy, back in the 18th and 19th centuries, was that you had empires crisscrossing, and my English pirates will happily go raid Spanish galleons and vice versa. And so ditto the French. And of course, that's terrible for trade. And it ended up leading to two world wars. And so we decided, okay, no more of that. We're going to patrol the whole, all of the world is going to be the American Empire-ish. And we're going to completely open up our markets. You guys can still keep yours basically closed. And we're going to militarily subsidize all of your trade, so you don't have to pay the security costs for securing your trade anymore. We're going to pay all of that for you. And that was how we bribed up the current order, which is now degenerated 80 years later, because let's face it, the Soviets aren't here anymore and haven't been for 30 years. And so at this point, 30 years after, because this was a military bribe for us. This current order was only about security. It was not about economics at all. And so when Trump comes along, he's like, this current order where we're paying $1 trillion a year to militarily subsidize the rest of the planet, this doesn't make economic sense for us. He's right. This order was not designed to do that. It was designed as a security, we're paying, it was literally guns for butter. So this thing has like completely fallen apart now, because there's no reason for it anymore. America does not have that incentive anymore to military subsidize the rest of the planet. And so, global trade system, it's basically falling apart because America doesn't give a shit anymore. And the supply chains, like, we're basically bringing our Navy home, but for like a little bit in the, we only have to, keep Taiwan safe for a little while, like maybe a few years. Because after that, the Chinese just aren't going to be able to attack it. They're just not going to have the economic capacity to fight a war with Taiwan. And I won't get into those reasons, because that's a lot. But basically, every 80. So basically, we go to like the fifth law of archotropism, which is basically the second law of thermodynamics, almost verbatim, that in a closed system, power always accumulates chaos and is subject to entropy, always subject to increasing entropy. And so the reason for that, is basically the law of diminishing returns, where, whenever you have like an order, a power order, an aggressive order that is imposed, because it's not responsive to market demand, because a market will always update itself constantly. And in order to kind of stay vibrant and alive and all that, and it will constantly update itself. And so that's basically adding energy. But because of power, this is imposed. It's not really demanded in the strict sense. It is, but not quite. But because of that, when it gets imposed, it's never really updated, and it only gets updated very slowly. And the updates are usually not good. They usually make the problem worse, not better. Well, what ends up happening after a while is that, you know, the value of this order just diminishes and diminishes and diminishes over time until the fact is like people are so furious that they really want this thing overthrown. And, you know, this, and because it just doesn't have value anymore. All the incentives have changed in the last 80 years. I mean, that was a different world back then. And and everything has changed. So, but we still have the same order. So like, that doesn't make sense. Obviously it's going to get overthrown because that's the incentive. And now and unfortunately the current order was trying to preserve itself in 2016 and 2020. And, you know, they freaked out because Donald Trump, you know, had basically had just been running on destroying the old order. Remember, the old order was like, okay, we're going to have an international currency, you know, guns for butter and, you know, free trade for everyone, stuff like that. And, open immigration and stuff like that. And Trump just ran on all three, just killing all three. So they freaked out because they don't want the order. And this is all of their vested interest that they're talking about. And they've had that for 80 years. They don't want that to end. And so they freaked out and they tried to get rid of him and they destroyed basically the integrity of the system to do it, you know, by cheating him out of the election. And yes, I do believe it was a very, very fraudulent election. But even if you don't believe it, they still just handed, you know, whoever are, you know, the problem that they just created was they completely delegitimized the Republican system, our Republican system of government. And well, you know, what that means is that whichever right-wing dictator wants to come along next, you basically just handed him a free pass to just obliterate the system and say that, you know, my mandate is to be a dictator and to, you know, get rid of these bureaucrats. We already saw how illegitimate this system was, you know, a few years ago when they outed Trump in fraud. You know, they, you know, defrauded us in broad daylight and then they gaslighted us for 4 years in addition to this totalitarian takeover of the economy and this gross violations of human natural rights. And, you know, and so I don't want to hear any bullshit about, you know, respecting the Constitution or rule of law or whatever. So you got, because they clearly don't care about that. My mandate is to just fuck this system in the ass and to, overthrow it and start a new system. That's my mandate. Vote for me. And you just handed a right-wing dictator a perfect excuse to become a dictator. And, you know, I mean, the Republicans tend to be spineless bastards. Yeah, but not their voting electorate. Their voting electorate is very strong-willed, but the Republican politicians that they elect always seem to be spineless weenies. So, you know, the incentive is there. If one of them decides, if there's any one of them that decides that, dictatorship doesn't sound all that bad, you know, then, okay, that guy has a perfect excuse now. But, you know, I don't know if we're going to, I'm not here to try to predict the future. I'm just saying this is the incentive and they just handed it to a potential white green dictator on a silver platter. That's incentives for you.
Yeah. Something you just touched on a little while back there was the idea that people are never going to choose liberty in chaos. I mean, 9/11, we have the Patriot Act. COVID-19, we get all the vaccine passports and shit, like whatever it is, like people just freak out and they instantly want more control. So how do you regain order without just becoming a totalitarian state and achieving liberty?
Boy, I got bad news for you. because of this archotropism, remember we defined that as, okay, you gain power by extracting order from chaos. You know, remember that four quadrant chart of, you know, of politics and, you know, political opinions and all that, and, you know, libertarians at the bottom, authoritarians at the top, left on the left, right on the right. Okay, well, if you're in the left libertarian place, that's basically where we started back when we were barbarians. That's, you know, libertarian chaos, you know, where, you know, we have no idea when the violence is coming. Like there's a tiger that just leapt out of the forest at me and I'm fucking scared. And, you know, it's like that's where we were at libertarian chaos. Because of this archotropism, though, that, you know, it basically, you know, order is always what's in demand. So what that means is that, okay, there's what I call pseudo demand that goes straight up. You know, that, okay, there is demand for authority to put down the chaos. And so basically your left half of the graph is always demand for the top half of the graph. And it can go either way. Now, the reason that, you know, you end up with a lot of like more totalitarian states, is that, you know, you can seize power, and then because this is, there's no actual market demand here, you can just keep it and you don't actually have to put down the chaos. Yeah, you do have to do a little bit of that, but that's where you end up with top left authoritarianism as like the default for basically all of human history. You know, but because you can just, you know, grab power and only do a little bit to mitigate the chaos. But because there's still chaos here, and people still want order, they want predictability in their lives. They can't plan if there's chaos, and just having authoritarian chaos imposed on you just makes your life just unbearable and unlivable. And you still want the real order. So people will try to move, and they'll try, or maybe they'll try to overthrow the government or something like that. And so eventually, what we end after like 10,500 years, so capitalism becomes possible 12,900 years ago when the planet warms up and makes agriculture possible. Agriculture makes big populations possible. That expands the amount of division of labor we can do and specialization and all that stuff. And so for after 10,500 years of basically fucking around and not getting anything right, we finally get to, basically Christian monarchy, which is like ultra low time preference religion coupled with ultra low time preference form of government monarchy. It's a very low time preference form of government. So at that point, we're really, really, really under consuming wealth. And therefore, we can start promoting and building all of these new kinds of orders, like what we have with like the college system and universities. We invented science, medicine, astronomy, all this good stuff that we actually use. Deep sea water navigation was humongous and doing that. And then we finally, in 1602, when the Enlightenment began due to the invention of the joint stock system, joint stock company, because the incentives there are literally perfectly aligned for economic growth. And probably won't get into those. Just take my word for that. That the systems, the Enlightenment began right there in 1602, March of 1602, because that was when we first invented the first joint stock corporation, which it perfectly aligns incentives for maximum growth. And what happened right there, where you have basically when you had Christian monarchy start up, you have now you've gone from the top left quadrant to the top right quadrant, and now order is always self-promoting. So you're always promoting more and more and more and more order, which is going to point you downward, to that, bottom right, coordinate. The problem that we ran into was that monarchy, any form of monarchy, not just Christian monarchy, but any form of monarchy has four or five major scalability problems. And the moment you start you're producing like crap loads of wealth, it's going to expose all of those system flaws because monarchy just cannot scale up that high. Like its number one problem is like the central planning issue. Now you have a substantially larger economy with that is way more specialized, and you can't possibly plan for all of that. So what ended up happening is that ends up causing chaos. You end up with other large concentrations of wealth that and that are larger than the king and can basically overthrow the king and install a republic, which does not have those same scalability issues. And So when you finally get rid of basically we ended up going back top left again because of those scalability issues of Christian monarchy. And what we've just said is that, okay, so bottom left, there is a demand, there's pseudo demand upwards to top left. So bottom left quadrant always demands top left. Anytime you're on the left, it has a demand for on the right, because we want order, we want predictability. And so, but you can't go straight left to straight right, because that's not the way the demand circuit works. But anytime you have top right authoritarianism, it always demands, spontaneous order, the more libertarian order. So unfortunately, the road to libertarian order, that's the right side of the libertarian quadrant, the bottom right, that actually has to go through authoritarian. Right-wing authoritarianism. And I'm just as a right-winger, it's like, okay, it's kind of preferential, at least to the totalitarian shit show we have right now. But it still gives me like an feeling that, okay, we're still going to be stuck with this authoritarianism for basically our lives. But the good news is it will get better. And, you know, we're probably going to go back to, you know, if we can get to a more corporate kind of monarchy, which is different, because what you're doing, what you can solve all of the scalability issues of monarchy by, you know, separating the ownership from management, because that was another major issue, is that the reason all corporations will try to separate ownership and management is because when you have the two combined, it gives you a perverse incentive where you want to loot the company. You know, where management wants to loot the company for their own gain. This was like Tsar Nicholas, or what was it, Anne something, and she like, oh, let them eat cake or something like that, because she's just out of touch. And you know, or you had like King Louis or something like that in France, you know, who's like living an absolutely lavish lifestyle while the peasants are, you know, not having a great life. And you know, but yeah, and this is like, okay, you know, the kings end up looting the nation basically for their own personal gain. But by separating out separating management from management from ownership, you can solve all of the scalability issues, and that will probably get us to the spontaneous order that we want to get to a whole lot quicker. You know, that because we won't be repeating the same mistakes of the past, we will have different mistakes to repeat. But you know, it would make the transition job a whole lot better. Because basically, we'd be running the government a lot more like a corporation than a traditional republic. And I think this is kind of what the founding fathers were aiming at, but they did it wrong. Yeah, the Constitution is very misconfigured. You know, where like, okay, I see where you're going. You had like you wanted 2/3 monarchy and like 1/3 republicanism ish, and that ended up having a weird effect where it basically it gave you like a low time preference republic, which is not natural. And what that caused is, you know, a massive expansion of wealth again, which again still exposed the, later on down the road after like what was it, 100 something years, you know, it finally the final, you had such a huge accumulation of wealth that eventually, blew up the monarchy portions of our constitution, and they were finally able to get rid of the final actual restraint on the government, which was the gold standard. Once we got rid of that within the Fed with 1913, that's when you see the power of the government just explode, because you had basically broke the price ceiling. What you did with the Constitution was you effectively put a price floor on the interest rate of power, or the consumption rate of power. You know, interest rates and consumption rates are basically the same thing. So you said, okay, we're going to artificially underconsume power. This is my third law of archotropism at work, that the value of power is subjective. Therefore, it's also subject to time preference. So if you're under consuming power, you have a low time preference for it. Therefore, you're going to get a massive explosion of wealth, you know, due to that. And this is what we saw in, you know, America and the Reconstruction and all that, and the Industrial Revolution. And unfortunately, you know, those same issues, the scalability issues that you had with with monarchy were still at play in our constitution. And yeah, so, and then when that finally exploded, you got 2 world wars right off the bat. Oh, well, that's under consumption for you.
So you actually have a plan for how we can get through this right-wing authoritarianism and maybe not give ourselves freedom, but maybe give our kids freedom. Do you want to talk about that? The anti-tax, just give us some framework on how that works.
Yeah, the anti-tax is basically, you know, my solution to, if you're feeling black-pilled about the problems of archotropism, don't be. It's like there are solutions to this, and there's actually quite a few solutions. But the one I've come up with after 4 years, but basically I invented the anti-tax first. Afterwards, I defined the first 2 laws of archotropism. I kind of got the third one from listening to Dave Smith, I realized some patterns, you know, that it had, you know, that archotropism was kind of mirroring thermodynamics. I still haven't figured out why that is, but it just is. So anyway, I realized, okay, if it's mirroring thermodynamics, I can probably find, you know, use the other law, you know, laws of thermodynamics to figure out where the other remaining laws of archotropism are. That's where I got, you know, 4, 5, and 6 from. And we haven't talked about all of them today, but that's not necessary. But in doing this, I realized the anti-tax that I invented, which is basically a heavily modified version of a sovereign wealth fund, that it's done at the local level, not the state level, not the federal level, because God knows that would be a disaster, down at the local level, like in a municipality, you know, and, you know, preferably in a red state, in a red area of a red state, you know, nice and rural or suburban, but, you know, red area of a red state is the prime place for this, because that's where the people, the kind of people you need for it, you know, will be most likely to be found. Now, the way it works basically is that, you know, we're going to, you know, it's initially this sovereign wealth fund, for people who don't know, this is something like what the Nordic democracies have, and or the or some of the you know, Arabian Peninsula monarchies have, where they fund all of their social welfare programs through profitable investment. And, you know, so they will invest those assets abroad, and they will, you know, kind of, you know, have a strict under consumption rate. So where this fund is always growing, like the one in Norway is like $1 trillion, and they're a really fucking small country. And so, I mean, they're like a country that's like lower, like about the size and consistency of Oklahoma. And there's like $1 trillion wealth fund right there in addition to the rest of their economy. So that's huge. And the, but you know, the way it works is they use the proceeds from the, sovereign wealth fund to fund their, welfare programs. We're going to do the exact opposite. And we're going to use, these miniature sovereign wealth funds, tens of thousands of them at the local level down in, you know, preferably red areas of red states, because that's where you have low time preference voters who have a very low time preference for power. It means they want to underconsume it naturally. And so the, and those are the sort of people who can manage this sort of fund, because if you put this in the big blue areas of big blue cities and big blue states, they're going to end up investing that in like socks for hobos or something like that. Right. And we all know how
that might help me. You know, that would be great for me, but no.
Yeah, you're not a hobo. Come on.
I have been in the past, so by choice. But
oh well, I had no idea about that. Anyway, this anti-tax basically is going to get, you know, grow and grow and grow over time. This basically this network of, you know, tens of thousands of sovereign wealth funds, which are seeded from the local government's reserves. So people probably don't know that usually your local government, if you're in a red area of a red state, will usually have about 8 to 14-ish months of capital on hand that just sits there year after year after year, gathering inflation. And so it's you could actually fund all of the government's, you know, local governments, I should say, for a year, you know, with no extra taxes. You know, they actually have that money on hand right now. Usually it's about around 8 to 14 months. So the what you do is, we're going to take all that money that's already been collected, so we don't have to raise taxes on anybody. We can just take the money that's already been collected. We're going to invest it in basically the classical asset markets, highly diversified. We're going to have professional managers do it instead of the politicians, because we all know how that would work out. So we're going to get the professionals involved, you know, who know how to diversify and, you know, mitigate risk and, you know, prevent, you know, over allocation to any particular one asset class. So you don't have all of your eggs in one basket. And if you have a stock market crash, well, you're diversified into a whole bunch of non-stock assets, which will, you know, be very low correlated and will be just fine. And so you don't have to worry, you know, when you have enough diversification, you know, in your portfolio, you don't have to worry about crashes. You know, it's not a thing. But you know, in doing so, you get less return, but it's also a substantially more consistent return. You know, there's a lot less volatile and a lot more predictable. And so, by doing this at the local level, because, you know, again, these are local governments, they don't have a printing press. And, you know, if they raise taxes too much, it's very, very simple for people to just sell their property and, you know, move to 5 or 6 miles next door to a local government who's not going to treat them like an asshole, you know. And So basically they're under extreme competitive forces already. This is why they're able to maintain, you know, like 8 to 14 months of, you know, capital on hand without just squandering it automatically, like you'd kind of expect them to do. But again, that's because they have competitive forces. And all we're doing right here is we're giving them one more way to be competitive with each other, where they can take these, you know, take this reserve fund, put it into a profitable investment managed by professionals. And that gives you a return on investment that can then be used to lower taxes. Because now, you know, what you eventually get to is where you can run the government entirely on a passive income. And you don't have, that local government will not have to raise taxes. And in doing so, you know, you also have, you know, a substantial amount of economic growth, because anytime you cut taxes, you're going to grow the economy. And not just that, but you're going to be, if you're having extreme competitive forces like the local governments have, you know, you're going to start drawing in a whole lot of extra people who want that. So, and, you know, if you're a local government who doesn't want to have all of their, you know, nice and profitable businesses and citizens, you know, moving out of their district into your next door neighbor, you're going to have to be a little more competitive too. So you're going to have to start making your own anti-tax fund, and so on and so on and so on and so on. So basically, once
all happens while the federal and state government just keep going until they collapse, right? Like, this isn't basically going to nullify anything they do, right?
Yeah, and that's basically the idea, is that this is a way for, and if you really like, if I'm in Texas, and I was born and raised in Florida. And so I'm a recent Texas transplant, but Florida man who now lives in Texas. But so if you're in a nice red state that has a good low time preference for power government, like Texas and Florida, you know, what you could do is hook this thing up to the to your state level government, and by just have, you know, lobby your Texas legislature to, hey, I have an anti-tax here, which is basically, you know, fully passive income for, you know, it's providing a full passive income for my local government to the point where I don't have to pay any taxes anymore. How about we set up a direct tax where you, the state legislature, are going to tax the anti-tax fund as a substitution for taxing me? And, you know, then you can actually get it to where you pay not only no local taxes, but no state taxes either. And so, and you could theoretically hook it up to the federal government the same way. And I figured you just, you know, get the chairman of appropriations to put, you know, a line item like that in one of those massive spending bills that nobody ever reads. And he'll probably be okay with it, because, you know, you could easily, I mean, it's in his best interest too, as like the guy from your district or whatever, the chairman who represents his district, he wants his taxes in his district as low as possible too, because he lives there, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's like, it's in his interest to cut his own taxes, you know, and you could easily convince them all that way. And if you can't convince him, you can certainly convince, you know, a whole bunch of the corporations who also want a way to cut their own taxes that, hey, corporations, this guy is standing in between you and a tax cut. What do you think of that? Oh, you don't like that? I thought so. How about we work together to change his mind?
And so everyone who's, you know, all about getting money out of politics, they're actually cutting their own throats, right? Like, they should be all about buying their local politicians, right? Buying their local government. That's kind of what you're saying here.
Well, basically, this is just, you know, they're already doing that, but I'm just giving them a better way of doing that. Yeah, this is a smarter way of running a government that literally works out for virtually every interest group. And so, but, you know, by doing this, I don't really expect any sort of pushback from them, even though I'm calling it the anti-tax, because what it actually ends up being is a way for them to cut their own taxes and their constituents' taxes, and to be substantially more competitive in their own district than everybody else. And because, you know, fuck the other guys, this is a republic, it's a democracy. Democracy is not a team sport. It's a free for all. You know, it's like, right, kind of a, people misunderstand that it's not a team sport. It's not a team sport. It's a free for all. And these politicians, they're not out in it for each other. They're in it for themselves. And
so this whole philosophy is really just recognizing humanity and the world for what it is, and then capitalizing on it in the best way possible. So realizing that the government is run by lobbyists. So become a lobbyist for your own local government instead of just thinking that they're someday going to leave you alone, right?
Yeah, you can take over your own local government, install the anti-tax, get five or six of them passed, you know, into law, And then you approach your state level government to say, hey, we'd like some anti-corruption measures. We'd like some professional management standards that you have to mandate by law, because this prevents a lot of your a lot of malincentives of occurring, because there are some people have tried this idea a little bit in the past, but they, you know, but what they ended up doing, the politicians managed to corrupt it, you know, by investing it in local assets, you know, that didn't really, that just were serving their own crony interests. And you need to, you know, nip that in the bud, you know, before it starts. So, you know, I would just approach the state level guys and say, hey, we want you to, one, raise taxes. I'm pretty sure they can manage that, you know, because it really, it's not a raise in taxes. It's a substitution of one tax for another. And this, their donors are going to like, their voters are going to like, you know, and they themselves will probably like. And, you know, we need you to, so, okay, so implement this tax substitution, or, you know, raise taxes, you know, or you can, yeah, and we also need you to have some anti-corruption standards, you know, some professional management standards and stuff like that, that are basically, they're like no-brainers. These are not like big asks. I'm not asking the government to shoot itself in the foot. I'm not, you know, I'm asking them to, you know, help manage their money a little bit better than they already are.
Yeah.
And so the, you know, it's like, there's no real threat to the government by doing this. If anything, I'm helping them, because I'm helping them be more competitive and amass more power by doing their, what they already want to do. And this is just a better way of doing what they're already doing. And it's going to be a whole lot lower stress on the people who live here. And, you know, this is something I've talked about a lot, you know, kind of with Matt Erickson from, you know, Wealth, Power, and Influence with Jason Stapleton. He also has his own show, King Pilled, about like, hey, you know, ideally, you know, if you really want to have your own liberty, you have to have wealth, you know, and preferably you have to have ownership of that wealth, and it has to be mobile. And, but that's not possible for everybody, obviously. So it's like, okay, you can say stop being poor, and that can be very, very true. And, you know, I understand exactly what he was saying with that, and I completely agree with the sentiment, but obviously that's not doable for everybody. So, you know, we need to provide wealth, power, and influence as a service to people by bringing them our mobility to them, and by helping them cut their own taxes, you know, you are going to be providing them with a whole lot of extra wealth where they can, you know, manage to start, you know, accumulating wealth, accumulating passive incomes and stuff like that. And they can actually go, you know, start helping them climb the value added scale. That's going to give them that, that flexibility, that mobility, and that they, that, you know, real libertarian independence, demands. So,
yeah.
So this is what, you know, the anti-tax ends up being wealth, power, and influence as a service to them.
Sure. So, I mean, a lot of what you're saying here is very, very similar to what Larry Sharp talked about when he ran for governor. I had him on my show back in January or something. Mm-hmm. So my question is the Libertarian Party necessarily at odds with this strategy? I mean, if you have libertarians trying to do this, is that cool? Or what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. If the, you know, the only problem that the LP is going to have is they have an L next to their name. And if you want to lobby your higher levels of government for the necessary anti-corruption and professional management standards and stuff like that, they're going to take one look at the L next to your name and say, fuck off. So, but if you know, but if you're the LP and you are wanting to pivot from state and national politics and pivot to local politics, which they're really not doing, and they are a little bit, but you know, the main focus is on the national politics and on the state level politics, which I feel are just ego trips, and these are worthless. They never win, and they're just wastes of money and time and valuable candidates who could be put to, there's an opportunity cost there where these candidates could be put to better use. Like if you had Shane Hazel in Georgia, instead of having him as the you know, your senatorial candidate, which was worthless and, you know, helped get, you know, a bunch of Democrats elected, you know, which sucked, you know, but you know what, if you had had that same exact guy as like somebody city councilman, he'd be a million times better, and those you know, whatever city he was councilman for would be a million times better for that. So if the LP ever wanted to pivot away from the worthless national and state politics and pivot to local politics, where they could actually, these are winnable races, you know, for an LP candidate. And you wanted to start doing the installation job of installing the anti-tax, getting it set up, you know, getting it properly funded with seed money and all that, that they actually could do very easily. And I would fully support them doing that. I don't expect it because they're usually not fans of mine because I'm a GOP guy. You know, Mises GOP, hi, I'm the leader.
Actually, I mean, not the anti-tax part, but when I had Spike Cohen on last time, he said exactly what you just did, that we shouldn't even bother with governors or congressional races. Like, it should only be city council, mayor. I mean, like, he said exactly what you just said right there. I do agree with you that most people are not on that page. I mean, most people can't say anything but who they want for president in 3 years. And it's like, I mean, put it like this.
Who's your mayor? What's his name?
Yeah, I don't even know off the top of my head.
I have no idea. I have no idea either. You know, it's like I'm the guy who says we should all be have local politics and all that. I still don't know my mayor's name. You know why? It's just...
Yeah.
So it's, and you know, I was, you know, doing this at like on an AMA a while back where I was showing like, okay, well, which local governments are good candidates for, for anti-tax and all, how do you identify them? And I was taking people through the process. And after the fact, you know, cause I use Lockhart, Texas, where Buck Johnson is from. And because I'm raising money to run him for city council right now.
Right.
And one thing we found out is that his city council woman who's representing him in his little district for his little city council is very, very unpopular, and she ran unopposed, and he could totally beat her as, you know, Fireman Buck. Everyone trusts the fireman, et cetera, et cetera. But what we also found is that the at-large candidate won with 4 votes. Not by four votes. In other words, you know, there are 5 people who voted in the election, and he was, and you know, him and his opponent were 2 of them. And his opponent had 1 vote; he voted for himself. And you know, the other guy, it's like, yeah, exactly. It's like, these are winnable. It's like, even for an LP guy, you could win this. Come on. And it's like, this is, and so, you know, it's like stuff like this. These are very, very winnable races, and it has a really high payoff if you couple it with like an anti-tax installation that cuts taxes for everybody. Because we looked at Lockhart, they had like 12 or 14 million or something like that in the bank. It's like, holy fucking shit. And it's like, it was enough for like a 25% tax cut for the property taxes right off the bat. A 25% cut. I mean, that's huge. That's
so life-changing for people. My question is, I mean, yeah, like you and I are way into politics and we don't even know the name of our mayor.
Yeah.
Most people don't even, I mean, they probably don't know their governor. They don't know their senators. They don't know any of their congressmen. Some of them don't even know who the president is. So, you know, I mean, I think there's utility in running someone for president to bring attention to things. But
yeah, I agree.
Even if there isn't, how do we get people to pay attention to local politics? Like, how do we get them to care about the anti-tax? I get how you can get the politicians to care, but how do you get the everyday Joe Schmo to care about what's going on?
You pay them to do it. You know, it's like kind of, you know, seriously, paying people to do stuff is like a universal behavior hack. If you want someone to do something, just pay them to do it. Everyone has a price, you know? And, you know, that's why, you know, would you have a system like Bitcoin, for example, which, you know, this is how libertarians invented a way for people to make money by educating themselves and other people about monetary policy. That's Bitcoin. You know, it's like if you buy Bitcoin, now you have a vested interest in educating everybody else about, you know, basically Bitcoin and good monetary policy. And, you know, and because when they buy in, that rewards you. That, so we basically invented a payment system to educate people. Same thing with the anti-tax is that, you know, we're basically, now that we're making it in people's interest to educate themselves and others about sound fiscal policy. Right. And, you know, so basically by handing them a perfect way to basically cut their own taxes to zero, you know, if they have sound enough fiscal policy. And, you know, by doing that, you know, by basically paying them in tax cuts, you know, I'm effectively paying them to, you know, to educate themselves on fiscal policy and fiscal matters. And so, you know, I don't really have to, you know, pay anyone to be interested in like libertarian politics. I just have to pay them to get interested in this, and that will kind of lead them to it. Same thing with Bitcoin. This is the Bitcoin is the monetary equivalent. The anti-tax is the fiscal equivalent. To where, I'm just going to pay them to educate themselves. All done.
Right. Yeah. What I wanted to kind of end on is, you've talked a lot about the failings of thin libertarianism. I think I agree with you to a point. Like, I think if you just have the skeletal libertarian philosophy without anything to fill beyond it, then, I mean, you're not going to have a very full life. You're not going to have much direction. I just think it's a mistake to exclude people who don't have the same philosophy that you do, maybe. But maybe I'm mischaracterizing what you've said. I just want you to kind of...
Yeah, I can talk about that. Yeah. Well, there are several problems with it. It's an ethical framework in search of a people. So normally the way you do laws is you don't base them on property, you base them on praxeology. And what I mean by that is you base them on the human behaviors that we have right now. And obviously there's the ideal of the natural order, and we kind of want to get as close to that as we possibly can, but we have to realize that we're a bunch of chimps. And, you know, we're chimps who behave our incentives, good or bad or, you know, or whatever. And so, again, this archotropism is basically all praxeology. It's all incentives, and it's all perverse incentives, really. And people are going to do it. And so what you need to do as a, someone who's making a law is that you don't make laws that people have no ability to follow. And so the, when you do that, you're basically, setting up a system where they're going to have contempt for the law, and people are going to be, like a prohibition on like sex work or drugs or alcohol or something like that. People do not have the moral capacity to, follow stuff like that. I'm sorry, they just don't. So, what ends up happening is that, people end up having contempt for the law, and they just break it, and they're going to do it anyway. And now you're setting yourself up for a prison state. Same thing with aggression. You know, if you just try to make a perfect society by law, what you're going to end up with is a massive amount of people who just have complete contempt for the law. And they'll just break it and break it and break it. And the more they break it, the easier it gets. So it's you never want to make laws that people cannot follow. Mm-hmm. So you can set ideals out for them as, the things to try to achieve, but understand that they're ideals, and you still have to make the laws for the time being that are much more consistent with the moral level that they have, and not the one you wish that they had. And so when you have a thin libertarianism or something like that, this is an ideal that is not fit for the kind of people that we have in 2021, much less 2020. Because we all saw what happened. When this panic came around, it was like, fuck private property, fuck natural rights. Like give me my stimmy check and the second one. And did we get a third one? I think we got a third one too. Yeah, we got a third one. And
I didn't get any. So, whatever.
Yeah, that sucks. Yeah, that really blows. But yeah, so it's like, and oh, by the way, we're all still on lockdown, and now we have forced vaccinations, and half the country is saying that all of this apartheid, this medical apartheid, isn't going far enough. So understand that these are the people we have right now. And we don't have a society full of libertarians. We have a society full of chimps. A bunch of bald apes, bald bipedal primates. So that's what we are. And from the law side, let's talk about praxis. This is kind of my biggest problem with thin libertarianism, is that it's a very incomplete philosophy, because again, it kind of assumes the world does not have archotropism. Mm-hmm. It's like it assumes that these incentives don't exist, and they do. And it's real. And so it's like, okay, you're building a law, around not, you're building a whole system of ethics that, it just ignores like one third of all human incentives. Because let's face it, predation normally is about a third of the economy. If you're looking at the state, how much they spend, it's about a third of the economy normally. Last year was substantially more, but that was an exception. Mm-hmm. But if you understand that, and by the way, that's being generous, to the productive sector, because let's face it, about half of that productive sector, or at least another one third, is in bed with the initial one third of predation.
Sure.
And they're in bed with the state, and so even right there, we're being kind of generous by, only limiting the states, to one third of all the incentives, because the capitalists do have a perverse incentive to get in bed with the government. And that didn't start with them. That's been there for like 6,000 years, all the way back to, to Sumer. You know, you can go all the way back to Sumer, and you can still find the money lenders trying to start wars between kingdoms so that they can capitalize on the debt. You know, they and it's like that's as old as human civilization, and it's not going anywhere. And so when you're trying to make an ethic around that, it's like, oof, you know, that's probably not going to work at all. And not and so and that probably makes it not ideal, because remember what we said earlier about you know, if your system of morals, if your system of ethics does not work, if it doesn't produce good results, it's probably not a good one. Mm-hmm. And so I just throw thin libertarianism basically out the window and say, okay, you're going to need to have something a lot more that goes along with it. Namely, you're going to need you know, some way of dealing with archotropism, and you have to recognize that this thing exists and it's a big mm-hmm. problem. It's sociopathic economics, as I call it. And but thin libertarianism, because it assumes that doesn't exist, it does not give you any sort of praxis for dealing with it. So because it basically assumes it doesn't exist, and or it assumes that it exists in such a small amount that it could be easily dealt with, and that people aren't naturally incentivized to want aggression, and it assumes that they all don't want to be the victims of it. Which is correct, but it also is, that's only half the equation, because remember, they all think aggression is good when they're the ones doing it.
Right.
You know, because that's the incentive, you know, and, you know, they all believe, oh, well, we want a minimal amount of it only for good enough reasons. And well, what's a good enough reason when I'm the one doing it? That's what that comes down to. And it's like, they're all minarchists, you know, when it comes to themselves, they're minarchists. When it comes to other people, they're totalitarians.
Mm-hmm.
And so the you know, if you don't have thin libertarian, you know, the second problem is that it doesn't tell you how to deal with that, and you can't just like create a security company or something like that for it, because again, well, you have to ask yourself the question I always ask to like straight up ANCAPs is, well, okay, in your ANCAPistan, who do I pay to go aggress against my neighbor? Like, because supposedly that's not supposed to exist.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, and there's a massive demand for that, as we just saw last year. It's like, I mean there's no counter argument to that, to say that doesn't exist. And then it's not only does it not exist, but you know, it does exist in humongous proportions. Like half the country was like, this medical apartheid is not going far enough. It's like, I don't know what to tell you. If you think that they're not wanting the aggression, you're delusional. You know, and I'm not saying you personally are delusional, but like, you know, they clearly want the aggression. And
I tweeted out, I don't know, a couple months ago, what's the saying? Like, everyone's a libertarian, they just don't know it yet. And then underneath it, I said, well, that was fucking wrong.
You know, yeah, I mean, clearly.
I think anyone who observed the last, the last year and a half has to recognize that. I think it's similar to what you're talking about. Like the realization I've come to is that humans desire comfort above everything else, and power is a form of comfort, you know, because you feel secure, you feel good about yourself. They're terrified of anything that's not comfortable. That's like why you don't want to ask a girl out, or you don't want to go ski a scary slope, or you don't want to try a new job. It all has to do with, you know, fearing losing your comfort, which, you know, kind of fits in with what you're saying. And not realizing that exists is detrimental, because you're just like a communist pretending markets don't exist and supply and demand don't exist, because you'll just be banging your head against the wall, wondering why people don't listen to you, wondering why nothing changes. But guys like you and Larry Sharp, made it obvious, like, you've got to entice people into liberty. You can't just, I mean, you can tell.
You got social engineer this, you know.
Yeah.
This is going to need to be heavily socially engineered. And that's why I push solutions like Bitcoin, why I push solutions like the anti-tax as ways of paying people to do the right thing. And, you know, and that's eventually how we're going to have to do all liberty, is to pay people to do the right thing. And that's a lot easier said than done. That's going to take a substantial amount of cleverness. And I don't have all of the solutions, but, you know, I can see for right now with the anti-tax, I can see how my generation was completely fucked you know, by the last generation. And I kind of, you're in that same boat as me, that our generation just got completely screwed. And
I think we're like pretty much exactly the same age. If you were in middle school in,
I think so. I think you're like maybe 1 year younger than me or something like that. And
27. How old are you?
Yeah, 28.
Okay.
So, yeah, like 1 year. And so basically you and I are like at that same level where, you know, we can take a look around and see all of our, you know, our entire cohort just got royally screwed by the last generation. And it'd be, I think as a generational aspiration, you know, the American dream kind of died temporarily with us. And I think we should be trying to revive it for the next generation. That should be our mission, to give them a better world than what we were given. And I think that starts with, you know, giving them better monetary policy through Bitcoin and better fiscal policy through the anti-tax. And eventually, hopefully, we can give them a tax-free government for them to screw up for themselves later. But, you know, but that's on them. So we can at least say we did the right thing. But because the American dream isn't that you yourself do better, it's that your children do better than you. And unfortunately, the American dream died with our generation, but we can always resurrect it after 3 days and, you know, whatever. So anyway, but the, but it's going to take a little more than 3 days. It's going to take, you know, maybe 30 or 40 years. But that's the basic idea, is that we should try to give the next generation a better America than what we were given. And because, you know, God, we have to be able to do better than this. You know, and I think that starts with taking some local power. For libertarians, we have to get over this allergy of being allergic to power. And we're going to have to start taking power at the local level, just straight up nullify the federal government and nullify the COVID regime. And like, this is not going to be, you know, what we're enforcing at all. And we're probably going to punish people for enforcing it. This is another critique I have of like thin libertarianism, is that it doesn't help you distinguish between good and evil. And it will often render bad results, where it will tell you that, oh, they have a right to do this, you know, this evil act like medical apartheid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the reason that's incorrect is, again, we go back to that four quadrant chart where, okay, there's a demand arrow pointed straight up from the bottom left to the top left. And, you know, the top left goes straight over, and then the top right goes straight down. So basically, if you want liberty, being this left side, this, you know, basically has a pseudo demand arrow pointed straight up, and that points towards totalitarianism. So anytime you're on the left, you know, you're creating demand for this sort of totalitarian government. And so, you know, this idea that the left half is compatible with the bottom half is just completely infeasible. It's completely incorrect, because this is a pseudo demand circuit that goes straight up. And by pseudo demand, I should probably define that. I know we're an hour and 22 minutes in, and I finally defining pseudo demand, but basically pseudo demand, it behaves like demand. So we mentioned earlier that, you know, that since the value of power is basically relative, it's basically that expected value equation. Well, what you do then is then you apply diminishing returns, which is how we get the normal law of demand from praxeology, that, okay, a producer will, you know, produce his most important things first that people will pay the most for, and then go down and down and down and down and down. And well, the predator, and that's how you get that descending curve of the law of demand. A predator will do the exact same thing, where, you know, his highest value predation goes first, then the lower one, then a lower one, then a lower one, then a lower one. And that's pseudo demand. So the more, you know, basically the, you know, the weaker of a pussy you are, the more you're asking for it, you know, quote, quote. And, you know, the basic, and so like, you're a big old bruiser, I'm probably not going to go pretty against you, you know, but if there's like a grandma on the streets, you know, I can easily snatch her purse and run, and because she can't get chased, she's not armed, you can't fight me back, you know, she's just a much easier target. Like if there was a cop, you know, I really don't want to predate on that, because he can, you know, kick my ass and will probably brutalize me and say it was all my fault. Yeah, for no reason. Yeah. So it's like police brutality is a thing. And it's like, so I really don't want to go predate against that, because I'm not going to win. And so like the cop is at the bottom, you know, Reed is slightly above the cop, and then the grandma's like up at the top, you know, in terms of who I want to predate against. That's pseudo demand. So it basically, it's the law of demand without consent. And so, and that pseudo demand is the circuit that points straight up, that it, that because, you know, you're in a state of weakness, you're an easy prey. And for a totalitarian,
right,
that's just how that is.
If I want to get some, I go get Clint because he's the sub in the relationship. So
yeah, you mentioned that, and yeah, we talked about that on his show. As like, who's the top? It's you know, you're the stud when I'm on your show. He's the stud when I'm on his show. But anyway, but yeah. So thin libertarians, it rendered these results where, you know, it's like, okay, one of these is clearly bad for liberty. If you define liberty and property as good, really, it's only the top. It's only the bottom right half that's actually what you want. That other left half, because it has a natural demand circuit for totalitarianism. You know, that's like, you can't really say that that's compatible with this idea of liberty. The bottom half is not at all consistent with the left half. You know, you get and the so.
What I'll definitely concede to you or agree with you on is that the idea that, you know, I remember Reason yesterday or the day before, they put out something saying that Abbott's mandate is just as bad as Biden's mandate. Mm-hmm. And like, no, it's not. I mean, it's like, it's the same principle that's being violated, but he's not forcing, you know, thousands of people to not be vaccinated. It's just ridiculous. So, I mean, in that light, I'll agree with you that there's sometimes when thin libertarians, yeah, they just see that some principle is being violated, and then all nuance just goes out the window. It's just like, oh, the
well, rule. If you understand that the natural order is what we define as good, as humans, we define the natural order as good, and mm-hmm. that's basically all spontaneous order. You know, bottom right. So when you're trying to have like a, you know, an authoritarian right that will try to force, you know, an order, if they're trying to force something that's closer to the natural order than what we had on the spontaneous side, naturally, because, you know, then that's actually morally better, you know, than the libertarian side. The reason being is this is closer to the natural order. And so like when you have something like a vaccine mandate, that is not anywhere close to the natural order, you know, and, you know, medical apartheid is nowhere close to the natural order. And what Governor Abbott did was he basically restored order to what it looked like in basically 2019 pre-COVID, and which, well, wasn't exactly natural, but is far closer to what was normal. So it's like by that actual definition, the authoritarian answer was better than the libertarian answer because it got closer to the mark. And, you know, it's like, and I have a tough time, you know, saying that, you know, this, you know, that not only are they not equivalent, but in this case, the authoritarian answer was actually better than the libertarian answer of just, oh, we need to, you know, let the market decide, because sometimes the market will make really, really bad decisions, you know, that are very contrary to the natural order. And a lot of times those are spurred on by the state. Yes, that's true. Like this, you know, was...
I was going to say the state usually makes more mistakes than the market.
Oh, it certainly does. Yeah, it certainly does. Yeah, absolutely. And especially because we live in a, you know, a very left-wing, democracy. Democracy is always left-wing. And so, because it naturally incentivizes you to consume the power of society, you know, and to create less of it, mm-hmm. or to consume the wealth of society and turn it into power. You know, again, this goes back to Rothbard, where if you consume wealth and you predate upon someone, you disincentivize them to create more further wealth. So you end up with a contraction of the supply of wealth in society. And so anyway, that's something you see with, anything that's left. And because of that, you know, this is a, you can, you know, discern actions of which ones are which. So, you know, again, this left side, you know, it naturally creates demand for a bigger and bigger state that by itself cannot be, you know, compatible with this idea of libertarianism and natural order and natural law. And, you know, and so what you would do, again, the road to liberty, unfortunately, usually goes through right-wing authoritarianism. And again, I feel as badly about that probably as you do. But the reason why you would want to move right first instead of trying to move diagonally down, the reason you would do that is because that kills the demand for order. So basically, once you've got the order, order always self-promotes, and that will spiral down into the and the other side. But when you try to just go down first, the reason is that that's less efficient, because what ends up happening is that you still have some demand for chaos, you know, that is just right there, that you have to kill the demand for chaos first, because that is what kills the demand for the state, and then you can go down and into that bottom right quadrant, which we all want, you know, the spontaneous order. And so those are like the three real problems I have. Is one, you know, it will give you bad results. Two, you know, that are really inconsistent with liberty. And again, you can always judge a tree by its fruits. Good trees produce good fruits, and bad trees produce bad fruits. And, you know, again, we can't just say, here's, you know, all the good work I did, and I value it because I'm the, you know, because of that. That's labor theory of value fallacy. And you actually have to say, well, what results did that produce? And thin libertarianism does not give you that. It does not give you good results. It gives you the totalitarian nightmare we have right now, where you end up responding to evil with peace, and that you should never respond to evil with peace, because that encourages it. But it also gives you, you know, the problem of, you know, like it doesn't tell you how to deal with this state that exists. You know, it just says, if you end up being peaceful yourself, that is what will promote order. And I'm sorry, no, that does not do that. No, you actually have to kill the demand for chaos first, because it's the chaos spurred demand for statecraft that is the problem. And you need to kill that chaos first, and then order can come down. You know, then you get liberty. And it doesn't give you any way of dealing with that. It doesn't even recognize that it exists. Yeah, it's certainly not at the quantities it clearly does exist at. And, you know, I forget what the other problem was, but yeah, you know, we're at an hour and 30 minutes, so I won't ramble for too much longer.
All right. Well, I will definitely have you back on again. I like this conversation. I think you have a lot of interesting things to say. I've got your YouTube channel and your Twitter page linked in the description, but where else can people follow you or help you out? Or
if you want to, if you want to hear more, particularly if you want to read more about this, I have a Subscribestar, you know, that is very, very cheap and affordable. And I post articles there, and they become free a month after I post them. But they only cost $2. But I also have a, you know, if you want to ask me a lot more in depth questions, I can't do that on Twitter because it's Twitter. But I can I always answer a lot of in depth questions in my supporting listeners group, which is again connected to the Subscribestar. That's only like $7. A month, and it's very, very cheap and affordable, and you get to ask me basically as many questions as you want, and I will give you very long and in-depth answers into these sorts of topics. If you also want to get involved with the anti-tax, you know, I have Mises GOP. We are not really here to compete with the LPNC. I don't view them as competition, but that's both me trying to be nice, and also, you know, I don't view them as competition. But if you want to get involved with installing the anti-tax in your hometown, you know, join up at Mises GOP, help us donate. We have a WinRed link that is in the description at GOP Mises on Twitter. And you can get involved there. Please help us donate. And we're going to be trying to install a few anti-taxes here in Texas first. You do them in one geographic area, and that should, you know, force all of the other local governments to adopt it. So you can get them to basically, we can Tom Sawyer our way to a tax-free government, you know, whereas they basically have to if they want to remain competitive. And so we're going to do a few of these first here. If you want to start doing that in your state, join up and donate, and we can get that started. We can bring wealth, power, and influence as a service to you.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, man. We'll do it again.
All right. Thanks, Reed.